The Yellowstone County Treasurer refuses to resign over racist emails he sent. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us why Helena hopes to cull more deer from the city limits. Flathead reporter Catchem Fry looks into a program to boost energy efficiency. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with the head of the Montana Food Bank Network about the growing demand for food aid. Yellowstone County commissioners have rejected the county treasurer's offer to leave office in exchange for a year's pay. Instead, they asked him to resign for making racist comments in emails sent from his government computer. The Billings Gazette reports the commissioners voted unanimously this morning to reject Max Lennington's buyout proposal for the final year of his term as treasurer, assessor, and superintendent of schools. Commissioner Bill Kennedy said he would accept Lennington's resignation but rejected the suggested $90,000 buyout. Commissioner Jim Reno then read a statement asking Lennington to resign, saying in part, quote, "Max, when you lose the public trust, it is time to resign," end quote. Lennington responded that he planned to finish out his term and retire at the end of 2014.
A Livingston man is charged with a hate crime after prosecutors say he directed racial insults at a Hispanic man, attacked him, and then struck him with a vehicle. The Livingston Enterprise reports Park County Attorney Brett Linneweber charged 34-year-old Robert Todd Kelsey with aggravated assault and malicious intimidation related to civil or human rights. Court records say the victim suffered a fractured skull and eye socket, along with internal injuries in the October 22nd attack. Prosecutors say Kelly's vehicle had blood on it and damage consistent with hitting a person. Kelsey also faces the revocation of a 5-year suspended sentence for a 2007 burglary in Park County.
And in other news from around the state, officials in South Central Montana have filed charges against a 31-year-old Washington State woman after a man was struck and killed on Interstate 90 near Big Timber in late September. Wyron Young of Oak Harbor, Washington, is charged with failure to remain at the scene of a fatal accident in Sweetgrass County and tampering with evidence for washing the man's remains off the pickup at a car wash about 40 miles away in Park County. Park County Attorney Brett Linneweber says Young was served with charges today. She was ordered to appear in district court in Big Timber on December 10th. Officials are still investigating the cause of the death for 81-year-old L.G. Bedford of Wasilla, Alaska. Investigators have said it appeared Bedford was struck by several vehicles.
An Anaconda man is charged with deliberate homicide after another man was shot to death while celebrating his 45th birthday. The Montana Standard reports 21-year-old Dylan Clark Jess was charged today in the death of Robert Merlin Furman. The judge set bail at $250,000. Prosecutors allege Jess shot Furman in the head with a shotgun at an Anaconda residence early Saturday. Police Chief Tim Barkell says the two men apparently knew each other. Officials have not released any other information about what led to the shooting. A Rocky Mountain College art student is suing the Billings School because she can't pass the math courses required for a bachelor's degree. Hannah Valdez's attorney says she has a range of disabilities, including Asperger's syndrome, bipolar disorder, anxiety disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and dyscalculia, which is a mathematics learning disability. Attorney Donald Harris said today that Valdez's disabilities prevent her from passing two math courses that are part of the general education requirements to graduate with a Bachelor of Arts degree. She's asking a judge to require the college to substitute two other courses for the math classes. A response filed in U.S. District Court yesterday by the college's attorney says school officials offer to accommodate Valdez, but it can't fundamentally alter its educational program.
Local electric co-ops are writing checks for a different kind of energy bill. Flathead Electric Co-op in Kalispell recently wrote a check to Plum Creek for more than $380,000. It's for energy-efficient upgrades at the lumber company's sawmill. Flathead reporter Catchem Fry has more on the effort to boost energy efficiency on an industrial scale.
Electric cooperatives like Flathead Electric buy electricity from the Bonneville Power Administration. Key accounts representative Don Newton says it's actually in the co-op's best interest to get members to lower their electric bills.
Because someday in the future, we're going to have to buy more power than what we're buying now. And once we reach that upper limit from Bonneville, we'll have to buy on the open market at a much higher rate.
Promoting energy efficiency is something FEC is doing through BPA's Energy Smart Industrial Program incentives. Newton says the efficiency programs tend to cost them less than 2 cents per kilowatt hour.
The whole idea is that we purchase the energy efficiency at a much cheaper rate than what we would purchase power from Bonneville Power.
Newton says Plum Creek is the co-op's largest single member and has been heavily involved in the energy efficiency program. Flathead Electric recently wrote an energy efficiency check to Plum Creek for more than $380,000. Newton says it's the biggest check they've written through the Energy Smart Industrial Program. Flathead Electric says the lumber company has completed 11 projects and received more than $2 million in incentives. These different projects tally up to saving the company from using nearly 14 million kilowatt hours. Plum Creek's most recent project cost them more than $520,000 and involved installing a new air compressor, advanced digital controls, and a 1,200-gallon receiver. The changes are estimated to save Plum Creek about 1.7 million kilowatt hours per year, reducing their power costs by $54,000 per year.
They have been involved quite a bit different and variety of programs. They've done commercial lighting. They've done some compressed air. Compressed air is an opportunity that is always out there for anyone who has compressed air. It tends to be inefficient. Also, some of the processes that they do can be streamlined. Some efficiencies can be gained.
Newton says F.H. Stoltz Land and Lumber out of Columbia Falls has also taken advantage of the program, as has the Kalispell Regional Medical Center.
They're installing a new heating system, the ground source heat pump, and they have a variety of programs that they're taking participation in, and also commercial lighting. So they're another big contributor to our efficiency programs.
Flathead Electric also has an energy efficiency incentive program available on the small scale for homeowners through rebates for things like having energy-efficient appliances, replacing windows, and installing heat pumps. Newton says the business investment generally pays off through the incentive checks and energy savings and helps the co-op in the long run by keeping it from having to buy more and more expensive power. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
A Canadian fuel supplier and reseller plans to enter the U.S. market with a $110 million purchase of a North Dakota fuel distribution business. Red Deer, Alberta-based Parkland Fuel Corporation, says it is buying all outstanding shares of SPF Energy Corp. for $89 million in cash and about $21 million in common shares of Parkland. The transaction is expected to close on January 1st. Parkland CEO Bob Epsi says that company's strategy is to grow in areas with strong future prospects where it can add value through strong supply capability. Minot-based SPF Energy is the parent company of Farstad Oil Incorporation and Super Pumper Incorporation. The company supplies 300 million gallons of refined petroleum products, including gasoline, distillates, and lubricating oils through North Dakota, Montana, Minnesota, South Dakota, and Wyoming.
We apologize for the earlier technical difficulties. We will return to Dan Boyce's story. The city of Helena is asking for permission to trap and kill 70 deer next year that live in the city limits. The State Wildlife Commission approves such requests. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us again, Helena has been working for years to lower the population of these so-called urban deer.
The state legislature started allowing communities to request permission to manage wildlife a decade ago. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Wildlife Bureau Coordinator Quinton Kujala says deer populations have been increasing in urban areas over the years for a variety of reasons. He says many people don't realize cities and towns actually can make really good habitat.
When you look at the green lawns, when you look at, in some cases, the open spaces, when you look at, in some cases, the riparian corridors.
People's flower beds and shrubs can provide a lot better nutrition than surrounding native vegetation. Plus, deer don't have to deal with predators in urban areas, so populations can actually grow within city limits compared with areas outside. Helena's a great example of this. City manager Ron Allis says the average deer populations around the state are about 13 per square mile. But a few years ago in Helena, he says the average deer per square mile was somewhere in the 40s.
Deer vehicle conflicts were way up. You had the conflicts with kids, dogs, people. There were just so many deer that were in our neighborhoods and across the cities.
These deer can be aggressive.
Those that have been born and raised in Helena don't display the same characteristics as a wild deer that runs at the sight of a human or, you know, some kind of predator. They actually become too comfortable around people.
FWP says Helena is the only major Montana community so far to request the ability to lower the urban deer population. 670 have been killed in city limits since removal started in 2009. Helena police officers set up nets.
They're trapped. They're dispatched with a bolt gun, and then they're processed, and the meat's taken to Helena Food Share, where they process it further and actually put it in packages for the homeless.
The state is allowing Helena to kill 200 deer this year, but does not allow any to be taken between the 1st of April and November 14th. Helena still has 60 left in its quota for this year. The city will be asking the state Fish and Wildlife Commission to kill another 70 deer in 2014. The goal is to end up with a deer population in Helena floating somewhere around 25 per square mile. Fish, Wildlife, and Parks says public comment on these Helena deer culling proposals is usually about 50-50, for and against. Many describe the process as too extreme. City Manager Ron Allis says Helena does not want to completely remove the deer population.
They are a part of our community. We want them to be a part of our community. It's part of the natural settings and urban wildland interface.
But he says the community needs to keep the population reasonable. The Fish and Wildlife Commission will vote on preliminary approval for Helena's 2014 deer culling proposal this Thursday. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
A national panel of judicial and law enforcement experts has released recommendations on how to make tribal communities safer. The Indian Law and Order Commission traveled around the country for 2 years to hear about criminal jurisdiction, tribal courts, grant funding, and other topics. The result is a 324-page report that addresses gaps in public safety. The report, titled Strengthening Justice for Native America, A Roadmap, was released today, a day ahead of the White House Tribal Nations Conference in Washington, D.C. Among the panel's recommendations is to give tribes more control over crimes on their land, including an expansion of authority to prosecute non-Indians. The commission chairman, Troy Ide, says Native communities face high rates of violent crime. He says outdated federal laws and policies are partially to blame.
A new biography of the great Oglala Sioux chief, Red Cloud, tells the story of Red Cloud's stunning military victories and eventual capitulation to Western white migration. The book is titled The Heart of Everything That Is, The Untold Story of Red Cloud, an American Legend. It is co-written by journalists and best-selling authors Tom Clavin and Bob Drury. Drury says Red Cloud is the only American Indian who won a war against the U.S. Army in the mid-19th century.
He was a brilliant military strategist and tactician, but he was also a shrewd politician, and he had foresight. He was a far-thinking man, and he saw the inevitable, and he said, okay, after he won his war, his next step was, let me try to get as much for my people as I can.
Drury was scheduled to speak about his new biography of Red Cloud tonight at the Payne Family Native American Center on the University of Montana campus, but because of travel problems, he was unable to make the trip. The talk has been canceled until a later date. However, we will have a feature interview with Drury tomorrow during Montana Evening Edition.
There are very few chances to step back, catch your breath, and admire one's work at the Montana Food Bank Network. It's always a busy place. In this evening's feature interview, Montana Food Bank Network CEO Gail Gifford tells Edward O'Brien about the busy summer season that just wrapped up, the rapidly approaching holiday season, and a new challenge that's causing network affiliates and those who rely on them to come up with creative solutions. First, more on the network's mission.
We are a statewide network of food pantries. We are the ones that work with the Feeding America Network, which is the larger food bank on a national basis, bringing food into the state of Montana and then funneling it down through our partner agencies throughout the state.
How many agencies?
We have 208 agencies right now that we partner with, and they are the ones that do the boots on the ground service, the pantries, kitchens, group homes, those types of things.
Are there more of them coming up all the time, or is the number of pantries shrinking?
You know, actually more and more are starting to creep up, and while we have 208 partner agencies, we know that there's more out there. And some of them are pretty subtle. It might just be a church that does outreach for their congregation, those types of things. But we're always looking for new partners to bring in, especially in areas where we don't work currently with.
Doesn't that put more pressure on you looking for more?
Absolutely, but that's our job. You know, that's what our whole role is. Our mission is to make sure that we get out into those communities, whether they have pantries or to help plant new pantries or to bring backpack programs, something something that be that is able to help those individuals in those counties and the communities in need.
Okay. Well, before we talk about the season ahead, let's talk a little bit about the past few months in terms of services over the summer. How was demand? How'd it go?
Well, the summertime is always a whole different challenge for us. A lot of the kids are out of school. They don't have access to snacks and meals through a daycare program or something. They're now at home, and the family's obligation kind of steps up a little bit more and has to take care of them. We also find that donations tend to be down a little bit through the summer months. Folks are out pretty busy, and they're not necessarily thinking first and foremost of doing a food drive or making a contribution.
So what does that mean in terms of your all services and how you respond to them?
Well, that's when we really have to pump it up and make sure that those donations that we get throughout the year are really focused on helping us purchase more food. Again, we have this wonderful network throughout the United States that helps us get food in on a very low-cost, no-cost basis many times. Through our network, we can bid on truckloads and only have to pay for, say, shipping instead of having to pay for the entire truckload of product. So we really do have to kind of get a little more creative, work with our neighboring states and bringing more produce in so that we can help to supplement those times when those pantries aren't necessarily receiving as much help from their communities.
Do you get state, federal funding?
We are contracted through the state purely to do the pass-through of the commodities program. So we do have the commodities come through us and deliver, because we have a six-week delivery cycle throughout the state. And so we will help if we're making that location stop anyway. We'll bring those commodities along with us.
From, you know, your Missoula base here, where's your furthest pantry?
I would say probably up in the, we do go as far as Sydney. That is one area, although that side of the state is severely underserved. Yeah. So that would be our furthest. We do about 10,000 miles a month in our route that we do cover. Our whole service area is 56 counties, although 31 of those are very much in need of needing some emergency food pantries and kitchens and so on there. But we do cover a lot of territory every month.
Yeah, I should say, boy, that's got to get, that's got to be difficult.
Yeah, it's a big state.
You mentioned the eastern half of the state. Now that, you know, the Bakken oil boom, I wonder if that's going to get more services out there for people.
Well, we're hoping so. That's been one of our focus areas and definitely an area in need. And you think, even though with the oil boom going on, what's happening is the people that are coming in and getting those jobs, who many of them are from out of state, aren't necessarily those that live there. And so the cost of living there has gone up dramatically. And now it's very difficult to keep the shelves stocked at the grocery stores that are there because of the population boom that they've had. So they've got their own elements of challenge. Challenges and can't necessarily say that the need has decreased just because now there's some higher paying jobs locally. There's still great need there. We haven't seen right now a huge expansion of any pantry assistance. I think it's been pretty explosive pretty rapidly for a lot of individuals, and they're starting to identify some pretty serious needs that they have of people who are now homeless that weren't before because they can't afford to pay the rent and those types of challenges that occur. So that is an area that we are looking at doing, but again, they've got so many challenges of their own. Infrastructure is basically one of them, making sure that there is an agency that can serve as a pantry that has that capacity to do that.
Even though your all services are high on the priority list, there are indeed other higher priorities at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. So the eastern part of the state, again, being a food desert area, meaning not only there aren't very many emergency assistance programs out there, but the challenge is just getting to a local grocery store. You know, look at how desolate those areas are, and it can be 30, 40, 50 miles before they reach the nearest services. And you take a family that is challenged to afford gas to get to work, let alone drive that far for groceries.
Boy, we take it for granted out here, don't we?
We really do. We do. We've got a lot going on the western side, although there's still a lot more need that we could probably address out here, but certainly the real desolate areas are the challenges for us.
Ms. Gifford, earlier this month, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program benefits were reduced by what, about 5%?
Right. On average, it means about $36 for a family of four will be cut, and that's an average, about 21 meals a month. So it's a pretty significant cut. SNAP benefits for an average family were lasting about 3 weeks out of the month, so they were having to provide for themselves, basically, either through their income or through emergency assistance for that 1 week. Now with 21 meals cut, you know, think of how long that is going to last. So we're probably looking at just half the month for SNAP benefits to assist them. And this affects 131,000 Montanans that will be receiving SNAP cuts.
Boy, you don't think $36 a month would be that much.
You wouldn't think, but they get very creative in the way that they budget their SNAP benefits, and it is a huge assistance to them that will be eliminated. And right now, pantries aren't necessarily feeling the pinch. We're just heading into the middle of the month, so the SNAP benefits probably are going to start running out here very soon, and that's when we're going to start to see the impact on our pantries.
And what sort of impact are you projecting, and how do you plan to respond?
Well, typically, the average person that goes to a food pantry goes maybe 6 times a year. What we're expecting to see is more frequency. I don't know that the pantries will be able to give them a larger food box. Most of them will be 3 or 4 days worth of food, depending on the size of the family and what their availability is. So we might see some more frequency from those individuals who are receiving those SNAP benefits and have gotten the cuts. As far as addressing it, again, it's just our creative ways. It's amazing when we start calling out into our networks and start working with our donors and the food contributors and so on, and what we can bring in there. Pantries might just have to start getting a little more creative in what they provide in their food box and the quantity that they provide.
How creative in terms of what they provide?
You know, one of the things that we are looking at and we're starting to see happening more and more is we're buying not just truckloads, but we're buying bulk product. So instead of getting a consumer size box of cereal, for example, we're buying a 300-pound, 500-pound box of cereal, and we're repacking that in our warehouse. So we have those capabilities of doing that, so it definitely saves. I mean, you can save quite a bit in just getting a 300-pound bulk bag of cereal versus having it packaged. That packaging's expensive. So we're looking at doing that more so now with some of those core staples like rice and pasta, not just cereal, crackers, pretzels, all of those things. Little by little, the pantries are beginning to establish that capacity as well. So we can ship down to them large bulk products, and they can break that down themselves. That's a huge step in enabling them to become a little more self-sufficient and also saving a lot of cost.
Yeah. So here you are getting creative. And on top of that, can you believe we're just a few weeks away from Thanksgiving and Christmas and the holiday season?
Yes, it is. It's amazing. You know, the Food Bank Network, and we purchase about 28,000 turkeys. Those have all been out into the agencies. We're starting to hear of them scheduling their food distributions. Don't know yet exactly how the contributions are going on their end as far as agencies that work with Toys for Tots and how their food baskets are pulling together. Those applications typically are going to be ending here pretty soon, and they'll have some idea of the if there's any increase in need from families that need assistance through the holidays.
How could the public respond if they'd like to help out?
You know, there's a couple of different ways. Look to see if there is going to be a holiday distribution in your community. A lot of agencies do this. Churches will do this. Salvation Army, St. Vincent de Paul. If you have an agency in your community that's doing any kind of a holiday distribution, step up and volunteer. One of the most rewarding things, I do that every year, is to be at a Christmas distribution where they distribute toys and food for the holidays. And the gratitude that you see from the families is tremendous. And then obviously make that contribution, because this stuff does not come all the time free. So make the donation. If you don't make it to the Montana Food Bank Network and you prefer to put it within your community, then certainly make that donation there, because their dollar goes a long way. From the MFBN standpoint, every dollar you contribute to us, we can purchase enough food for 3 meals.
So cash is a great way to leverage them.
Yeah, to leverage their donation. Yes. You know, for them to go to the grocery store and buy a dollar worth of product isn't going to get them nearly as much as what that dollar we can do within our system.
You said those food distribution events are very gratifying. They're not depressing?
No, they're not. They really aren't. And I think a lot of that is because the people that come to you aren't depressed themselves. I mean, they're very thankful. They are very grateful for the agencies that can do that distribution for them. They're always very upbeat. It's amazing what the human nature, you know, how much they can really thrive. And it's just when you see that sort of a thing, they're so happy and so thankful that they're able to provide for themselves and their family.
And if people would like to help out, they can donate directly to the Montana Food Bank Network, correct?
Yes, they can. They can go to our organization's website, which is mfbn.org. And we have a number of different ways that they can make their contribution through that website.
How?
Well, they can do it online through their credit card. They can send in a donation. We also have a direct mail campaign, and hopefully they're on our mailing list, and they can receive their giving envelope that way. Or they can certainly, if they're in the area and they want to stop by MFBN, they can drop off their contribution that way.
Fantastic. Gail Gifford, CEO of the Montana Food Bank Network, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of rain and lows in the upper 20s to mid-30s. Tomorrow, look for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain and highs in the 40s. In central Montana tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain showers and lows in the 30s. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain through the day. High should be 45 to 55 degrees. Expect west winds 20 to 25 miles per hour with gusts up to 35 miles per hour in the afternoon. Southwest Montana should be mostly cloudy tonight with a slight chance of rain and snow showers. Expect lows 30 to 35 degrees. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain and snow and highs 45 to 55 degrees.
Currently in our listening area, Helena is 43 degrees with partly cloudy conditions. In Kalispell, it's cloudy, wind 42 degrees. Butte has 53 degrees under partly cloudy skies. Great Falls is clear with 57 degrees. Here in Missoula, the temperatures under partly cloudy skies is 41 degrees. It's 50 degrees and partly cloudy in Dillon. In Hamilton, it's partly cloudy and 45 degrees. Libby has 41 degrees with cloudy conditions, and Polson skies are cloudy and it's 41 degrees.
If you have a comment about tonight's newscast, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.